Welcome to Shortcut to Sunday. I'm Ben.
I'm Bruce.
And this is your podcast for February 11th, 2024, Transfiguration Sunday in Year B. And we are coming to you not live on behalf of Holy Family Episcopal Church in Fishers, Indiana. Bruce, how are you transfiguring this week?
Oh, I don't know. But I think that's the point.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
It's up to God, not up to us.
Without going into the story, let's unpack what this Sunday means. Transfiguration is even a word that I think people at home might nod along and go, yes, yes, yes. Okay, provide me a definition. I have no idea. You know what I mean? Like, what is?
But
what
I
is,
like it.
What is it? Right. Yeah. I know it's good. Transfiguration Sunday. Good. Jesus. Good. God. Good. Like, you know what I mean?
Two thumbs up.
Two thumbs up. Way up.
I just thought I'd help.
10 out of 10. Would recommend. But if you were forced to put a definition behind transfiguration and Transfiguration Sunday, I'm not entirely sure many of us would be able to do it, and probably including me. I mean, yeah.
It's definitely one of the least popular holy days in terms of they're not interesting traditions about.
Well, it's not Christmas. It's not Easter.
It's not Shrove Tuesday with pancakes.
Right.
But it is the occurrence that takes place just before Jesus goes to Jerusalem for the last time.
Mm-hmm.
In some Gospels for the first time, but to be crucified. And on the mountaintop, various interpretations of what the name of the mountain is, Jesus appears with Elijah and Moses and is transfigured.
Don't give it away. Yes, but what does that mean?
I'm purposely pausing so that people go, what? What? Okay, too much drama.
Wait for it.
We don't know.
Okay.
It's not that it's a made-up word. It's in Greek. It really is trans and figured, put together, mm-hmm. changing appearance,
mm-hmm.
Is the literal definition. But while it describes Jesus' clothing turning bright white, Jesus' face turning bright white, it doesn't explain how, doesn't explain exactly why. Which actually makes it a good miracle. It's not just a plus B equals C miracle.
Mm, mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
It makes it hard to develop a food tradition around it.
Right, or, right.
Yeah, let's all go build booths like Peter suggested stupidly.
Yeah. I'm typing in here. I just want to see like if there's a different – like. What you're describing, also another word that comes to mind is like transformation, like a transformation. So what would be the difference between transfigure and transformation?
Well, the answer that I've been told in the past is transfigure is changing the appearance.
Mm-hmm.
Transformation is changing the being.
The substance, the substance, whole yeah. of it. I gotcha. Okay. 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 So it's a metamorphosis of some of kinds.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
But it doesn't last.
That's true.
In this case.
That's true. That's true.
It's
that's
a temporary thing.
That's true. So yeah, Transfiguration Sunday, the end of the book end of the Epiphanies.
Right.
Right.
It's the final revelation
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
of who Jesus is until there's the resurrection, which is the ultimate revelation.
We'll get into it when we read the story a lot more, but it is kind of funny where it's like, this is like a, you know, this is the aha moment. This is the, and yet really when you think about it, it's, especially in the story, like all the different gospels where this occurs, it's still for everybody else, I think I get it. Yes, this is more confusing than before. I'm even a little bit more confused, actually.
And saying stupid things.
Yeah. Which, you know, hey, we're human. And that if we have the market cornered on anything, it's saying and doing stupid things.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, let's before we get to transfigure our conversation into something deeply theological and smart, let's go back on this day in church history and see other instances where we've been dumb.
That kind of is the theme of church history.
It kind of is, although, you know, dumb. Just, you know, terrible, sometimes positive, but usually one or the other.
Let's just say if there's fire involved, it's dumb at best.
There's fire involved. It's fire involved in easily these first two, and I think maybe in one of the others. Anyways, we'll start here at 1302. Philip IV, whose nickname apparently is the Fair of France. publicly burns Pope Boniface VIII's bull, and the bull's name, the edict, if you were.
Yes.
I'm going to butcher this, I'm sure, but it's called Ascolta Fili. Sure, why not? Which that bull was calling on Philip IV to mend his ways. So he burns a letter essentially from the other guy saying, hey, you need to get right. And he's like, ha ha ha, light you on fire. the Pope and the King have been bitter foes. And I assume with the burning of this letter,
things remain
bitter foes. I don't know as if that fixes anything for them. Because
they're sneaky. I think they're about to start the two popes era, but I could be wrong on that.
I think you might be right. I think that is that's around the time where that starts. That divide really becomes very apparent.
Basically, the French king says, you're not my pope. This guy's my pope.
Right. You're not my real pope.
Right. You're not the boss of me.
So there's some burning there. There's not direct burning in this next one, but it's around, and you'll know immediately what I'm talking about. Tomás de Torquemada, whose name will go down in infamy, is appointed Grand Inquisitor of all Spain.
That never ends well.
Yeah. So for history buffs, if once you hear the name Torquemada, you know.
Run!
You know what's going on there in Spain during that period of time.
What year was it again?
1482.
Okay. Your fun fact for the Spanish Inquisition.
Yes, which nobody expects. Ha 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 ha.
Duly noted. There's an outrageous theory, as in unproven, but I like it, that one of the motivations of Columbus to sail away from Spain was the Inquisition. And you know, like, get out of town, this ain't going to get better.
Right. If I could just get to open waters, yes, they can't torture me.
Yes. And if I can find either a shortcut to the Indies to have profitable trade, or a whole other land where I can just live, then my life will be better, and some of my best friends who are Jewish, their lives will be better.
Yeah, no, and
again, unfortunately, not able to really prove it. But
it sounds like one of the things that, if it were true, would not be well documented. That right. would kind of fly in the face of, like, boy, I sure hope that they don't find out.
Exactly.
I write with quill and ink.
And put on a shelf in
Should
my living room.
Should Torquemada find this, my life will be forfeit. But I write it anyway.
So I don't forget.
Exactly. Just note to self, Spanish Inquisition, bad. Got it.
Run away.
1526, we see some more burning, but it's just a books. Luther's books are burned at St. Paul's, London, and Thomas Bilney is forced to abjure his, I love this this line here, forced to abjure his mildly reformist views.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the fun of English Reformation history, which, again, Episcopal Church was formed out of. It didn't take much to raise a stink,
mm-hmm.
because they're, you know, you're changing this prayer. Swords!
Right. Just opening up the jacket.
Yeah.
Are you sure? Yeah,
exactly.
You sure you want to do that? Sure do like that prayer.
My queen loves that prayer.
Right.
Okay, never mind.
I just thought we could update it with that. No, that's good. It's fine. It's fine where it's at. 1909, William Wade Harris desecrates the Liberian flag and plants a British flag in Liberia, hoping his Gribos compatriots can become a British protectorate. Instead, Liberian authorities imprison him for treason. While serving his sentence, he claims to receive a vision from Gabriel and would become an evangelist, a miracle worker in the Ivory Coast and Gold Coast, convincing tens of thousands to... I want a lot more information about this. He's convincing tens of thousands to burn their fetishes and receive baptism in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Fetishes is an old anthropology word for false idols.
Okay. That makes more sense.
Yeah.
Like, my brain was like, I'm not sure how people, how you burn, like, I'm in defeat. Burn it. What? I don't know. I don't get it. Okay.
Oh, that kind of fetish. Now you explain it. Let me go.
So, okay, that makes a little bit more
crawl
sense.
Crawl away on my stumps.
I'm curious. I'm a little curious about the social political situation there in Liberia, because the second half of the entry makes him sound like, oh, he was being oppressed and, you know, did good things. But the first part of it does kind of, well, you're in Liberia.
Yeah. Why are you starting a revolution?
And you're planting the British flag, which doesn't have the, I know it's 1909, so it's better, but it's not, they don't have the greatest history, especially in Africa. So
I'm pretty sure Liberia was a uncolonized country at that point.
Were they? Okay.
The Italians came in and grabbed a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
But it was set up originally to be a place for North American enslaved people to go, so that the United States didn't have to deal with them anymore. That's why it was called Liberia, freedom.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have to admit, my knowledge of what was taking place in 1909 in Liberia is really weak.
Yeah, mine too. Mine too. So it's one of those, William Wade Harris, need more info. Yeah. Just to kind of have an idea as to, is this hidden a transformation, story where he kind of reforms his viewpoint and his thinking and then goes
and purpose. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. 1933, we see the death of Archbishop Simon of Shanghai and Beijing. Under his leadership, the Orthodox mission in China experiences significant growth. That's from orthodox.cn.
Yeah.
I wonder
whatever became of them, because you sure don't hear about the Orthodox Church in mainland China today, or Taiwan for that matter.
Yeah, I don't know.
I just don't know.
Maybe that's also on orthodox.cn.
Yeah.
1997, our last entry here, death in Ecuador of, how would I say that? Giquita Wewe. I think that's probably right. One of the killers of Jim Elliot, Nate Saint, Ed McCauley, Peter Fleming, and Roger Udarian. He had become a Christian and led his people to leave their violent lifestyle. So I'm there's so much more potential story there. He was one of the killers of what it sounds like missionaries, and then he became a Christian, maybe.
I'm just saying, with those names, I mean, that was a really violent era in Central America and South America around Roman Catholic Jesuits, especially, and some Franciscans, who were very progressive and favoring and working for land reform and things like that. So there were a lot of murders of Jesuits and Franciscans. So maybe he was part of that repressive movement and repented from it. But I don't know.
Interesting. Need more info. Another one where we need more
I'll continue to just make up stuff here as long as you want me to.
Yeah. What was his home life like?
Oh, too many video games that were way too violent.
Right, yes, I'm sure. Well, let's move on to our first reading for the week.
Yes.
Our first reading, which we don't get to read from these books often enough. I love 1st and 2nd Kings. Love these books. But we're reading from 2nd Kings, chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. Now, when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. The company of prophets who were in Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take your master away from you?" And he said, "Yes, I know. Keep silent." Elijah said to him, "Elisha, stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho." But he said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they came to Jericho. The company of prophets who were at Jericho drew near to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take your master away from you?" And he answered, "Yes, I know. Be silent." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan." But he said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. 50 men of the company of prophets also went and stood at some distance from them, as they both were standing by the Jordan. Then Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water. The water was parted to the one side and to the other until the two of them crossed on dry ground. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me what I may do for you before I am taken from you." Elisha said, "Please let me inherit a double share of your spirit." He responded, "You have asked a hard thing. Yet if you see me as I am being taken from you, it will be granted you. If not, it will not." As they continued walking and talking, a chariot of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them, and Elijah ascended into a whirlwind into heaven. Elisha kept watching and crying out, "Father, Father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen." But when he could no longer see him, he grasped his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. So this is Elijah's ascension.
Yeah.
So first off, there's a couple of references I just want to clear up. The company of prophets.
They're the bad guys.
They're the bad guys? Okay. How so?
False.
False prophets. Yeah. Okay.
So part of the fun is that they're saying the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so God is willing to use them, but not give them enough to become powerful.
Okay. How do they know? Was it like announced or something?
No, it's God did tell them. So this is one they're getting right.
Oh, so they're probably like approaching every town they come to, they approach them and are like, "Hey, I've had a vision. God says."
It's like, yeah, old news.
Although Elisha is like, "I know, shut up."
Yeah.
"I'm not happy about it."
Right. Well, I mean, it is kind of like, "I saw your boyfriend dancing with the cheerleader at the prom."
Yeah.
And person saying, "I know, shut up."
Well, I'm aware.
I'll deal with it later.
So in this one day, they're coming from Gilgal to Bethel, then to Jericho, and then they cross the Jordan.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's a long trip, yeah, right?
It's not possible to do it on foot in one day.
Okay. So either that makes the false prophets wrong.
No.
Or
it's
They were
the wrongness is
they were road runnering their way across.
it's to say, this is symbolic, dudes. Don't take it literally.
I gotcha. But because we're called to take the Bible literally, how do we make sense of this?
Feels so good. it's as happens in many places in the Bible, there are places mentioned or even highlighted that geographically don't make sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it's a callback usually to something else or a foreshadowing of something
mm-hmm.
else.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, the River Jordan, it's a callback to Moses not being allowed to cross into the Promised Land.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. The very Mosaic would be the term, maybe, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess.
But confusing to use that word.
Yeah, it would be a little confusing to use that word. I'm going to do it anyways. Another Mosaic-related imagery here of, like, striking the ground and the waters parting, too. So,
and striking the waters and the Red Sea's parting.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
One
of those powerful pieces of fabric, the mantle.
Yeah. What's the mantle?
It's like a blanket you wear over your shoulders.
Okay. So, not like a religious...
No, it's not. I can't believe he's carrying that big piece of wood around. We don't even have a fireplace anymore.
Moses used a staff. Elijah smacked the ground with a blanket.
Yeah.
Gotcha. I'm not sure if we're supposed to infer that the 50 men of the company of prophets that go with them, at least to the Jordan, cross with them. They kind of just get left off the story.
Yeah.
I suppose with the language written down as the conversation between Elijah and Elisha, it's further inferred that they are alone because Elisha, quote unquote, asks for a hard thing.
Yeah.
Let's help me unpack this, though. He asks for a double share of Elijah's spirit. At first blush, that kind of sounds like I want to be twice as good as you.
Well, yes, but really, it's I am so less than you. I'll need a double share just to become close.
Okay. Okay.
You know, if I get one share of Elijah, I'll be still way short.
Gotcha.
And two shares, at least I'll be presentable.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. He responds and says, if you see me as I am being taken from you, it will be granted. If not, it will not. So we're left to believe that this was granted to him because he does see him.
Yeah.
Being taken up. It's very dramatic.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Looks for a great stained glass window.
Yeah. Elisha on the ground mid Hulk rip of his cloak.
Yeah.
A chariot, a blazing chariot of fire, you know, whirlwinding.
Mm-hmm.
Elijah
peeling out across the sky.
Yeah.
Smoky tires.
Yeah, it does kind of. Now I'm just picturing like Elijah as a greaser and being like, "Burn asphalt, buddy. Woo! I'm out."
Yeah, I was thinking a little more modern than that of the sideshows that are so popular now.
No. My brain went to like American Graffiti,
yeah.
Car yeah. racing. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's the King James version.
Hey, you know what? Young Harrison Ford as an Elijah? I'd watch that show.
Yeah. Good movie.
It's a great movie. This is obviously, for those who know the gospel story already, this is a good setup because...
good callback.
Elisha's coming in, he's the hook. He's one of the hooks for later.
Yeah.
This is this will be a callback, but it's a handoff of sorts between the two different yes. prophets. Elisha was essentially like the understudy for Elijah.
Mm-hmm.
And Elijah to this day is a highly revered prophet within Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to a Seder, a space is left for Elijah.
Yeah.
Not Moses, right. but Elijah.
Yeah. In many ways, Elijah is considered more faithful to God than Moses was.
Mm-hmm.
Because Moses kept doing, kept getting off track.
He had a rough start, number one.
Yeah.
But...
but more importantly, Elijah was the one who never physically died.
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay. He has a body. He can show up.
Yeah.
And have supper.
Yeah. Which is very interesting. It's an interesting difference though, that then creates between Christianity and Judaism, in that like any waiting for Elijah to, you know, you could potentially come to the table is fully left behind in Christianity. And
for the most part,
it's like, well, nah.
There are
if
some,
we want anybody at our table, it's going to be Jesus. Like,
there are some Christians though who still practice an Elijah chair, and usually with the metaphor of we never know when a stranger is going to join, you know, come to the door. We need to be ready to welcome that stranger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you know, going back to another Hebrew scripture thing of entertaining angels unawares. So it may not be Elijah, but it could be a divine intervention in the
mm-hmm.
family or the community that's gathered there.
Yeah. Again, we could have a whole conversation about literalism versus poetry or storytelling,
metaphor,
mysticism, yeah. Kind of story here. I assume I know this answer, but we might as well ask it out loud so that podcast listeners can hear as well. Does the Episcopal Church have an official stance on the undying person of Elijah?
No. It's not considered crucial to one's understanding of self, God, or the world.
Gotcha.
And so a wide range of opinions are within the tent.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. That said, most Episcopalians would probably say, could be historical, could be metaphorical, still has meaning either way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's one thing that we struggle with sometimes as humans is metaphorical meaning being somehow illegitimate.
Right, right. You know? It's not true.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's not. If it's not true, then it's worthless.
Yeah. Whereas sometimes the poetic image or the metaphor is much more full of truth
mm-hmm.
than what people think they saw.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Anything else about this reading?
Yes.
Okay.
There's a very legitimate strain of thought within scholarship that the Elisha
mm-hmm.
events biography actually was written before the Elijah.
Huh.
And that the Elijah pieces were written so that they fit in with Elijah's narrative.
Interesting.
Because there are a lot of events in the life of Elijah that echo Elijah, if we read it in order.
Mm.
But and I haven't done this, but if we read it in reverse, apparently it works just as well.
Huh.
That Elijah is copying what happened in Elijah's life.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm.
It's a lot longer than the book of Jonah. So I won't tell people, just read all of 2 Kings.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating to think about as we do read the parts that we do.
Hmm. going along that line of potential metaphorical understanding, this could be a narrative way of granting this double spirit.
Right.
Of essentially, you know, the Elijah, Elisha, name is very similar too, of being doubly effective as a result of, you know, a longer ministry maybe or something. So that's interesting. I might have to go back because I do like the Kings.
Yeah.
I do like the Kings books. They have some wild stuff.
And part of the things that a lot of particularly Christians won't realize is that the Kings books, First and Second Kings, are leading right to the conquering by the Babylonians and being taken into exile, even to the extent of mentioning that the icky Israeli king, when the Babylonians invaded, chose not to return and instead lived out his life as honored guest of Babylonia. That's something I had forgotten until I was just getting ready for today.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, let's move on to our psalm. Our psalm this week comes from chapter 50, or the 50th psalm, since not really chapters aren't quite appropriate, verses 1 through 6. The Mighty One, God the Lord, speaks and summons the earth from the rising of the sun to its setting. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God shines forth. Our God comes and does not keep silence. Before him is a devouring fire and a mighty tempest all around him. He calls to the heavens above and to the earth that he may judge his people. Gather to me my faithful ones who made a covenant with me by sacrifice. The heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge. Selah. Okay, with the stage direction of Selah, one can infer that this psalm is used for temple worship.
Right.
But what else do we know about the psalm?
You're completely right, and that the type of worship would have been a liturgy of renewing the covenant with God.
Mm.
So, you know, hopefully people did, like we renew our baptismal covenant, usually 4 or 5 times a year. It's hopefully something that took place in the temple in Jerusalem repeatedly. And so this would be one of the hymns used.
I'm trying to figure out how the reason for, because usually the psalm is carefully chosen to either connect to one or the other readings, and I suppose there's, no matter what, there's kind of like a general possibility of connecting a psalm to any reading of like, reverence of God, and that also,
you know, we like God,
yeah, God way up, thumbs way up for that guy. But like I'm as I'm reading this one, I'm trying to figure out maybe why it was chosen.
I think the images of bright light, fire and God shining forth, the rising of the sun. I was reading it backwards.
I suppose before him is a devouring fire and a mighty tempest all around him does mirror the whirlwind.
Yeah.
Chariot of fire, horses and horses. Chariot of fire and horses of fire.
And also,
eat your heart out, J.R.R. Tolkien.
And also the transfiguration of Jesus, the purifying event for Jesus.
Yeah. How long is this psalm?
Let's see.
Because we're only getting a subset of it.
Verse 6. It's 23 verses.
Okay. I have to admit, I'm struggling just a little bit to come up with questions about this psalm. It's, you know, relatively straightforward. It does all the good things of like talking about how great God is, and also has, I suppose this is one of those psalms, though, that can fall under the potential category of misuse for fire and brimstone style Christianity. He calls to the heavens above and to the earth that he may judge his people.
Right.
So maybe a question about the word judge?
Well, before that, in the verse, is calls on the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
Who's he calling to? It implies, and in the Hebrew, it's very strong implication that this is one of those poetic instances where God is saying, hey, I'm the one true God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all those other gods, yeah, they're kind of hanging around the heavens, and I just have to snap my fingers, and they snap to or disappear.
Mm-hmm.
But really, all they can do is watch what I do.
Yeah.
They don't have any power to do anything themselves.
Yeah, there in verse 4, I kind of get the feeling that maybe rather than the word judge, it's probably more of an intonation about dominion, like jurisdiction, area of authority, as opposed to, like, you know,
yeah,
plucking you and putting you on the weighted scale and...
Yeah, one of the translations could have been to govern.
Okay.
Yeah,
which would make more sense. Mm-hmm. But we do like our fire and brimstone language.
We like our fire, brimstone, and judging.
Yeah, exactly.
It's what we would do.
Right? And since we are in the image of God, therefore God must be judgy.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to me. It makes perfect sense in that in the Hebrew scriptures, when monotheism is being introduced, they seldom, the prophets, the poets, seldom say, there's just one God, so shut up.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they'll use these images where it's, okay, yeah, you can believe in your gods, but they can't do a thing.
Right.
All they can do is sit and witness to what the one true God does. So why bother believing in him? I mean, just undermines their authority, their power. Why have a fetish carved mm-hmm. in their likeness?
There you go. Good callback. Good callback. Call I like it.
And they're essentially, they'll fade from the theological scene mm-hmm. because, they don't do anything.
Yeah.
But it is a process. It's not just overnight.
Yeah. Anything else about the psalm?
What word is that? I'm just looking at the Hebrew.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Nope. I had already said it.
Riveting. Well, with that, let's move on to the gospel reading, which, you know, you're already ruined for the rest of us. You already told the story. it's Mark chapter 9, verse 2 through 9. So since it's Mark, it's to the point.
Mm-hmm.
Our reading this week is 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Then Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. He said, not knowing what to say, for they were terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice. This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him. Suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no one with them anymore, but only Jesus. And as they were coming down the mountain, he ordered them to tell no one about what they had seen until after the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So, I mean, they use the word transfigured right here in the Mark translation. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling it would be subtly nuanced some other word. I don't think transfigured was necessarily a word when it was written. So I'm not sure if there's any interesting there.
Let's see. Wait, am I in the right chapter?
Chapter 9?
Yeah.
Verse 2?
And there verse we 2. Go. It looks like it was the Greek word for being transfigured.
Oh, so the Greek at that time did have a word for that.
Well, Greek then is like German now, where you can pop stuff together.
Oh, okay.
And make, and there's the word you want.
Gotcha.
And so I don't know. I don't know how common it was in other Greek works. This particular form, interestingly, only occurs in Matthew and Mark. And I'm looking at Luke. Yeah, Luke does not say transfigured. He just says, as Jesus was praying, the appearance of his countenance was altered. And his raiment, it's close, became dazzling white.
Gotcha. I love the word dazzling. It's very showy.
Bing!
Right? Very Saturday Night Fever. Like, oh, it's blinding. but I do. I also love the tail end of that verse. Such as no one on earth could bleach them. It's like it could not be more white.
Yeah.
Couldn't possibly be more blindingly white.
Well, and yeah, because in became shining white is the literal translation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it takes three words to say it in English. And in one of my translations here, that his garments became glistening, intensely white. Whereas there's just one word that's shining.
Yeah.
Or radiant.
Yeah. It makes me wonder if initially it says that they see Jesus talking with Elijah and Moses. It makes me wonder if Elijah and Moses, when the conversation first starts, could you like tone that down just a little bit?
Okay, I don't know how to say this exactly, but what if Jesus's appearance was what Elijah and Moses had gotten used to in heaven? And that was the only way they could easily see Jesus.
Maybe.
I never thought of that before or read it anywhere.
Or is Jesus dazzling white and Elijah goes, oh yeah, check this out. Flames. And Moses is like, I don't have that. Like,
I got broken.
Yeah.
I got gravel.
I could turn this thing into a snake. I can make water shoot out of this little rock.
I can get really ticked off with God.
I like the Mark description here for what Peter says, because in some of the other gospels, you more get the, you know, he just says the dumb thing. But in this one, it takes the extra step of saying he didn't know what to say for he was terrified.
Yeah.
They were terrified. And so this, it's so good for us to be here. Three dwellings all the way around. Dwellings for everyone. Yes. One for you. One for you.
How we doing?
How we feeling about this? Should I go? I feel like I should go.
Four is a crowd.
You guys are busy. You guys are talking. Oh no, I inserted myself into the conversation. They're staring at me. He's staring at me.
And then
Moses is looking at me.
And then comes the voice from heaven.
Right.
Just blows Peter away.
Yeah. And then it kind of seems like maybe Elijah and Moses were like, all right, I'm not going to stick around with this guy. No, this guy's here. Anyways, Jesus, good luck.
It's going to hurt a bit.
Here's a pat on the back. Elijah's like, I wouldn't know. Sucks to be you, bud. But yeah, this verse 7 does. Do we not have the baptismal story in Mark where the voice of God appears?
Let's see.
Because this kind of seems like maybe it's a supplement for that that entry. Like, I feel like one of the Gospels doesn't, like, and I think it's Mark that just jumps right through.
Mark ends the baptism story, which is three verses. And a voice came from heaven, you are my son, the beloved, with you I am well pleased.
Okay. All right.
But it doesn't say who heard it besides.
I got you.
It implies Jesus and John the Baptist.
So it's not a supplement. It is a callback. So because this says, this is my son, the beloved.
Yeah.
Another same use of the word. Listen to him.
It is almost like, in case you didn't get it before.
Right. Right. And so what's great about this story is from then on, they totally got it. They didn't march down the mountain and then immediately muck it up.
Again. Right. Except they did.
Yeah. Except they did. And they did. Despite all these signs, this is what's so great. And I get it. Like, don't get me wrong. It's easy to criticize. Not only because we have all the rest of, you know, the gospel and the writings, like, we're not in the moment having to decide at that time, how do you interpret this? What do you do? What do you say? Of course they're terrified. And of course they have no idea. Like, all of these concepts are so far outside of the norm that it's, I just imagine that maybe there was like one of the disciples was like at the end of it, like, called it. Peter, I don't know what you were doing, but what did I say? I said this would happen. And then when he says this, that's what he meant. But did anyone listen to me? No, you said I was crazy. You thought that was insane. And who's laughing now?
And to quote Mark, and Jesus said, what were you talking about on the road?
Right.
That's what follows
this. Right, yeah.
When they're walking down the mountain.
Not only do they not, a very recognizable reaction like, you know, hey, there are these two historically holy men who are like the mouthpiece of God.
Right.
Appearing before you. What do you say to them? Hi. I'm Ben. Can I get you anything?
Yeah.
Are you comfortable? Like, I don't know how this
coffee?
Works.
Do you like coffee? Do you I'm know out what of coffee
my,
is? Right,
I'm out of my element. Bottled water? Are you thirsty? Maybe you want to lie down. I know that we've had a conversation in years past about how the three dwellings were, in a way, in this instance, kind of another callback to the three dwelling idea, a callback to this past Sunday's a gospel reading, talking about like, hey, let's set up shop here.
Somewhat, yeah.
So there's kind of a little bit of that, like, hey, this could be a holy site. That's what this means, right, Jesus? Like, this is what we're here for.
And what's beautifully true is we have no idea where this took place.
Yeah.
The
mountain apart.
Yeah. There's no clue where it is, except it's walking distance to places in Galilee, which is full of high mountains.
Right.
So I think that's part of the beauty of it, is God choosing this place that's unknown for the place that we're not supposed to know where it is.
Well, that's one way to look at it. The other way that I just looked at it is that's the only part of verse 9 that the disciples keep. Because the verse 9 is the one where he says, all right, now don't tell anybody about this until, you know, until later. And
that's true.
Maybe that, you know, because obviously this story is recounted by them.
Yeah.
Jesus didn't, or at least one would imagine, when Jesus is resurrected and coming back from the dead, he doesn't sit down with someone to write the story like, all right, let me tell you this one time that I took, you know, Peter, James, and John and, you know, did the thing. Like, so it's unlikely that this came from anybody other than Peter, James, and John. And I wonder if maybe one of the side effects of him saying, now don't tell anybody about it. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll tell you this story. I'm not going to tell you where it is.
Because we're not supposed to go up
there.
We're
not. Yeah. I'm not going back there. I made a fool of myself.
Yeah.
I bet Elijah and Moses are still there waiting for their dwelling that I offered them. And they didn't tell me no.
But they didn't say yes.
They didn't tell me no. God spoke to us. I looked up and they were gone. Maybe they'll come back if I build a dwelling place. I don't know.
And what's one of the things that's fun is if we continued in the reading, which of course we didn't, Jesus in Mark pretty much, well, very explicitly says that, yes, Elijah is the forebearer.
Mm-hmm.
And he came and no one liked him. And he was referring to John the Baptist.
Oh, okay.
I'm just seeing. And Matthew does that as well, but not Luke. That Jesus says, I tell you, Elijah has already come, and they did not know him, but did to him whatever they pleased.
Gotcha. Yeah, this is one of those.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So in John, Gospel of John, Peter is described as a follower of John the Baptist.
Okay.
Not in the other Gospels, not in Mark. But so in theory, he could have recognized Elijah if he still looked like John the Baptist.
Yeah.
Which, just to add to the freak out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dead guy.
You have your head again. You were beheaded. Yeah.
This is one of those stories that, thankfully, I am not a person who would have been in this moment and had to have chosen, because I am sure, gone down in the annals of history as doing something way stupid.
The aluminum shed apostle.
Right. And there, appearing before them, talking with Jesus, was Elijah and Moses, and Ben pooped his pants a little. Just a little bit.
I think drove to Menards, got his aluminum shed, came back, set it up, and said, where'd everybody go?
Now, Ben would have done God knows what. So thanks to Peter for biting the bullet for us.
Yes.
More
than once.
Yeah, exactly. And it is interesting, though, also that I don't know as if verse 7 is yet another, like, attempted course correction by God and Jesus for these men, or if it's just another kind of like a knighting ceremony of like, you know what I mean? Like, was this for like, one imagines like a fantasy game where this is the power-up level for Jesus, right? is this the power up level for Jesus, or is this like, okay, since you're not listening to my son, I, God, am telling you to listen to what my son says. Pay attention. And verse 9, like, don't tell anybody until the Son of Man raises from the dead. And then shortly thereafter, they're going to be like, no, you can't die. Right,
right. Yes.
And Jesus just, God just sits there. Oh, my goodness. What can I do?
Okay, I just got to say this. Elijah, John the Baptist, baptism, and now the words being repeated by God. Elijah standing there saying, I know this one. No, don't talk over God.
Yeah, you really do want this story to last longer. You really want like Elijah to be like afterwards, still there. Elijah and Moses would be like, do you understand, Peter? Do you get it now? Like, yeah, we're gonna do that. No, Peter, seriously,
put down the pita.
Right.
We don't need
James,
to eat.
John, you going to help this guy out? Or like, no, just as lost? Okay. All right. You're going to let him talk so that you don't have to? I gotcha. Okay. Peter, let's talk about... let's dissect you just a little bit. Let's talk about you.
When I say Savior, what comes to mind?
Do you find yourself regularly confused and, you know... Is this an ADHD problem, or do we need medication?
Let's work on your listening skills.
Oh, goodness.
Pair it back exactly what you heard God say.
I, Peter, do hereby understand that Jesus must die for our sins and will be raised from the dead. I don't know. What?
There's got to be a better way.
I blacked out. What happened? Anything else about this gospel reading?
Rich, but I think we have it too often during a liturgical year.
We do have it. We usually have it like at least twice.
We'll have it this one. We'll have it for sure on Christ the King Sunday, as just before Advent starts.
Yeah,
December or November, and usually midsummer it occurs again.
Huh.
More in the chronological order of going through the Gospels.
Yeah. This is the all-star team, the religious all-star team story.
It's kind of the greatest hits. Let's play it again.
Yeah, right. Remember that time? Well, I think with that we will call to a close this your podcast for February 11th, 2024. Just a reminder: Transfiguration Sunday in Year B. We didn't do it at the top of the broadcast,
that means that coming Tuesday is pancakes.
That's what I was gonna say. Yes,
Tuesday
we've got
after Transfiguration
Shrove Tuesday,
and then Ash Wednesday services.
What time are those? Noon and
7 p.m.
Okay.
Pancakes are 5 to 7 p.m. in the parish hall.
Mm-hmm.
And next Sunday, the Sunday after Transfiguration Sunday is the bishop's visit.
Yes.
So many things happening.
Yeah. So, yeah, a lot of things happening. We always still encourage you to visit the website to see what all is going
all the
on.
Updates.
HolyFamilyFishers.org. And as always, join us this coming Sunday, however that works for your schedule. The 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock services with the 9 o'clock educational hour, also broadcasted on our YouTube channel, HFEC Videos. And until next week, I'm Ben.
I'm Bruce.
And we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.